Franklin County Education Foundation will be passing the plate in a few moments. Uniformed officers will ensure that you have the opportunity to contribute before you leave.
It's terrible.
Mr. Chairman, if we could just do one thing to make sure that Scott Birmingham can hear us. Scott,
sure.
Can you hear us? Scott?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, all right. We're live with the attorney on the line.
Okay. That's a frightening thought right there. By my clock and the clock in the back, it's 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so this is a meeting of the Triumph Gulf Coast Board of Directors. Call it to order and ask our Executive Director, Susan Skelton, to call the roll, please.
Mr. Benz?
Here.
Mr. Benz?
Here.
Mr. Connolly?
Here.
Dr. Dana?
Here.
Senator Gates?
Here.
Mr. Lee?
Here.
Mr. Riggs?
Here.
Mr. Schott?
Here.
Quorum is present, and Susan, I think your mic may not be working, so you may want to check that. Why don't we begin by thanking the Franklin County Commission for their generosity in allowing us to use their facilities today. And my understanding is that our County Commission Chair, Joseph Parrish, is here with some words of welcome. Mr. Chairman, thank you again for allowing us to be here.
Thank you, Senator. And I'd like to begin by welcoming the Triumph Board here to Franklin County and welcoming all the public. As you can see, the building's pretty full. Usually not this full unless we have a controversial planning and zoning action happening.
Nothing controversial, nothing to see here.
Yeah. So, again, welcome y'all to Franklin County. Just give you a quick update. You're in the beautiful city of Apalachicola. To our west, to our east is our historic city of Carrabelle. In Franklin County, that's the only two municipalities here. Franklin County is 72 miles long. There's more coastline in Franklin County than there is the whole state of Alabama. Having dealt with Senator Gates during the BP oil spill and a lot of members in this room, I appreciate your effort in developing the Triumph Fund. As we all know, it comes from the BP oil spill and trying to diversify the economies of these 8 disproportionately affected counties. So again, welcome to Franklin County. And I hope you enjoy our beautiful city and our beautiful county. And thank you again, the public and the board, for coming to Franklin County. One more thing is, I commend the board for going to these different rural counties as well as the bigger counties to conduct these meetings. It's very beneficial to the public in general, and it shows that you have a genuine care for either as well as the smaller counties to the more urban areas. And again, thank you for doing that. It makes everybody accessible to this board meeting, and thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate it, and we are here because Mr. Schoaf made sure we were here today. He said the next meeting will be in Franklin County, and so it is. Are there any other elected officials who are here today? If so, would you please stand and let us know who you are and who you represent? We'd be delighted to recognize you. Yes, sir.
Boardman Daniel, Gulf County Board of County Commission.
Phil Griffith, Bay County Commission.
Al Cap, Mayor, City of Mexico Beach.
Brett Lowry, City of Fort St. Joe.
Laura Edwards, Mayor, City of South Shelby.
I'm the City Commissioner.
And was there someone else in the back?
Ricky Jones, I'm Commissioner for Franklin County.
Well, thank you all very much for your time. We know that you could be somewhere else doing important business, and we appreciate your being with us and helping us and offering any of your insights as we go forward.
Mr. Chairman, we are looking for some more chairs in the back, just to let
there
you
are
know.
A few are up here, too.
Okay.
Well, the chairs, you saw the superintendent from Franklin County here. The chairs will be $200 each, if you'd like a chair.
We'll raffle them off.
We'll raffle them off, right. Our legal counsel, Mr. Remington, is with us by phone, and his partner, Ms. Bill Meyer, Bill Heimer will be here just in a few moments. We have the pleasure of having a new member of our board here today. We all were very sorry to see that Bob Benezzi resigned. Bob sent a very eloquent letter of resignation because of other commitments and other priorities in his life. He certainly helped a great deal in bringing us forward to this point, but we're pleased that Speaker Corcoran has appointed Ben Lee as Mr. Benezzi's replacement. Ben is the market president for Hancock Whitney Bank in the Bay County region. Prior to that time, he served as executive director for the Office of the State Attorney, where he was responsible for the management of 7 state attorney offices in 6 Florida counties. In that regard, many of you probably have seen him and worked with him in that capacity. He was born in Georgia, so the Gators and the Seminoles are going to have to just decide where he fits into all this. Has a bachelor's degree in economics and a master's in business administration from Auburn. And what impressed me a lot about Ben is the work that he does in the community. He's very active in the leadership of the Bay County Chamber, the Bay County Economic Development Council, Covenant Hospice, the Bay County Contractors Association, Haney Education Foundation, and the Holy Nativity Episcopal School Board of Directors. And he also serves on an oversight committee that provides governance oversight on the sales tax that was passed in Bay County, which is a critical issue and a critical position. So, Ben, we're delighted that you've joined us on the board, and I'd like to recognize you for any comments you'd like to make.
Thank you, Senator Gates. I'm very honored to be here and be a part of this board. I've got a steep learning curve, I know that, and I'm looking forward to making it, learning as quickly as I can and getting up to speed on all 116 projects. I'm just honored to be a part of this, and I hope to get to know each and every one of you more as we travel this journey. Thank you.
And the other point of transition, thank you, Ben, the other point of transition today is that Speaker Ben's is sitting there, and I'm sitting here. I know it's a shocking thing to you, I was fortunate to be elected to succeed Speaker Benz as chair of the board. And as we move into actually evaluating and awarding transformative economic development and economic diversification projects, and investing $1.5 billion that our Attorney General was able to secure and a settlement from BP. I think it's important to note that without Speaker Benz grabbing hold of this, when it was nothing but words on a piece of paper, words in a law, but totally unimplemented and unfleshed out, unless Speaker Benz had grabbed hold of it, had formed this board, had formed the corporation, had begun to set a process in place for a thoughtful evaluation of our options and an articulation of our vision, we wouldn't be in a position now with a strong team ready to move forward to evaluate proposals and award projects. So, Speaker Benz, you've always been the leader of Northwest Florida. You are now. You always will be. And I appreciate everything you've done to bring us to this point, and any good work we do, and I expect we'll do a lot of it, will be because of the leadership foundation that you've established.
All right.
Well, Doug, thank you very much. It's been a long journey, but you were the father of this whole thing, and I remind people of that. And it's only appropriate that you would, after 2 or 3 years, I've grown weary of being chairman. I've gotten to where I love the term former chairman or former speaker or whatever. I really love that term a lot better than current. So having said that, I also want to welcome Ben Lee here. Ben is a rising young man in our community in Northwest Florida. He's a sharp business guy. He's a banker. He will bring really neat things to this board. So Ben, I'm looking forward to working with you. I have high expectations of you. But most importantly, President Gates, you've done a great job. of birthing this project, making sure that those of us, those counties that were harmed, received a fair portion of the ultimate proceeds. And thank you for all you've done, and I really look forward to your leadership. You're going to do 10 times better than me. Easy.
Now, that'd be the first time that happened, but thank you, Mr. Speaker. And now I'd like to ask our Executive Director, Susan Skelton, if she would introduce our professional staff who've been placed in position at the direction with approval of the board since our last board meeting. Susan?
I believe the microphone is on now.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With great fanfare and hallelujah chorus from me, I'm glad to announce that we actually have here in person the two people who you all have had the opportunity to learn about as we went through the hiring process. Dr. Rick Harper is the former director of the Haas Center at University of West Florida. He's a renowned economist with expertise in the Northwest Florida economy. He joins us today along with Ms. Corey Henderson, who comes to us from Enterprise Florida as a former program administrator and director at Enterprise Florida. She has many, many years of expertise in exactly the type of work that we're going to be embarking on. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to meet them and them an opportunity to meet you. They're here to make recommendations today. And I will tell you that it has been like drinking through a fire hose because Dr. Harper joined us middle December, and Corey's been with us exactly 14 days today. But we have been able to form a very small cohesive unit, and I think we're going to be able to be productive as we move forward from today's starting point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Susan. You'll hear more from Dr. Harper and Ms. Henderson later in our meeting. Let us move now to review and approval of prior minutes. Let's take up the December 8th minutes. Is there a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved. Second.
Moved by Mr. Shopes, seconded by Mr. Connolly. Is there discussion or other questions? Does any member object? If not, show approved as presented. Now let's take up the December 27th minutes. Are there questions on those minutes? Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Moved by Speaker Benz. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Dana. Is there discussion or other questions? Does any member object? If not, show it adopted. And now, Ms. Skelton, why don't we go to a report updating us on our computer system and where we are with administrative issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to report that we have been able to matriculate off of my old computer, which was my personal computer, onto the computers that the board has purchased. Myself and Ms. Henderson are both using board-owned computers that are now running through a network system, so the information is secure and protected in the network system. And we are working towards the implementation of the phone system for the board members and staff. And just a quick overview, the way that will work is that there will be a phone number, which will be the centralized phone number, and each staff person and board member will have an extension, and that will be we'll discuss the technical details of how that will work. But you will be able to receive and make calls out on a Triumph Gulf Coast phone number in the very near future. We're working through the last little technical steps of that in the next day or so. So I will be in contact with you with instructions for that. I think I've gotten two-thirds of the board on the email addresses now. I have a former chair and a chair who are both on, and Jason, who's always our number one guy, and Mr. Connolly, and I'm still working to get everybody else on an email address, but we're very close to having that in place as well. Office space, we have in fact encumbered an office at the Clark Partington Destin offices. Chair Gates has signed an agreement with Clark Partington for the lease of that space on a monthly basis, as the board has approved. We've been using the Clark Partington conference rooms when we've met in the last several weeks as we've prepared for this meeting today, and it's been a good working relationship, and we're pleased with that. And Mr. Chair, at this point, that's the extent of the administrative discussion that I have for today.
Are there questions? Questions from any member? Susan, when the telephone system is finalized, will we then put it on the website so that members of the public who'd like to contact a member of the board, to contact our professional staff, will have a number that they can use?
Yes, sir. I'll give you a preview. It's the same phone number we've been using for the last 2.5 years. I will be getting a new phone number, but the phone number that will be used for Triumph will not change, so nobody has to go out and put a new number in their phone for contact purposes. It will be the 387-9405 phone number.
All right. Any other questions? If not, Mr. Remington, are you still with us, sir? Scott?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can. Liz, as far as I can tell, is not here, but would you mind moving into the legal report, please?
Certainly. With respect to the presiding officer's letter on January 18th, at the request of the chair, I sent a letter to President Negron and Speaker Corcoran with some questions about Triumph funding, specifically asking for clarification with regard to whether or not Triumph funds could be used in connection with private entities or private infrastructure. I have not received a response from that letter as of this date. As soon as I do receive a response, I will send it out to you. I believe a copy of that letter was provided to all the board members and should be in the package for today's meeting. Ms. Billheimer, if we could skip the gift ban reminder. I think Ms. Billheimer was going to do that in person when she arrives. Maybe easier, more appropriate for her to do so. She should be there in the next 10 or 15 minutes.
That's fine. Let's stop and ask any questions that members may have about the letter that you sent to presiding officers. We had a discussion about this at the last meeting, and the letter was sent pursuant to that conversation. But are there any questions? All right, if not, we'll skip the second part of the legal report for now. We'll move into the finance report and recognize our treasurer, Stephen Riggs. Mr. Riggs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In front of you and with a blue backing, you will see a copy of the financial statements. This will go rather quick because the financial statements today look very similar to what they have the previous several months. On our first page, we have our balance sheet. We have roughly $300 million. And in the liability section, you have to remember that the interest that we earn, we turn back around and make a wire back out to the DEO. So we have that liability shown there for the interest that we've earned. On the next page, you'll see our statement of activity. Think of it as our profit and loss statement. And again, our burn rate was about $30,000 this month. And again, barring any unforeseen expenditures, our burn rate will be about $30,000 a month. On the next few pages, they have some additional information. On the last page is our budget to actual. Again, our budget to actual so far year to date, we're okay. We're within budget. So that is my financial update. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the treasurer? Any questions? If not, Mr. Riggs moves the concurrence and approval of his report. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Connolly. Are there questions? Is there debate? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, show it adopted. And now let's move to proposed bylaws change. And Susan, are you handling that?
Yeah, I'm handling it.
Oh, are you handling that?
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Riggs.
Okay, again, it's actually an amendment and restatement of our articles of incorporation. And again, your packet, you'll see that information. The only thing we've changed is the type of not-for-profit status. Again, we're going from a 501A to a C, and all this is going to do is just smooth the process to get our IRS determination letter as being a not-for-profit. So it's a very minor change, and I'd like to move to approve this change to our articles of incorporation.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Dana. Are there questions? Steve, could you tell us, is there any material change in what, in the operations of the organization as a consequence of this change in status?
Absolutely not. This is just a minor, very minor technical issue to get our IRS determination letter.
All right. Is there debate? Is there objection? Does any member object? Yes, Mr. Connolly.
More questions. My apologies, didn't get there fast enough. So in terms of our filing for 2017, we haven't filed anything with the IRS. So anything new we're going to have to do retrospectively?
No. Again, we will file. We have plenty of time to file. If we need additional time, we could get an extension. But once we get this IRS determination letter, we will be able to. We're also going to begin our audit. In the meantime, so usually subsequent to completing the audit, assuring we have good numbers, then we will file our tax return.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Debate? Any objection? Show to adopt it as presented. And now let's move to the recommendation for payment of prior services. Let me say by word of introduction that when Speaker Benz basically created this organization, he did so with the help of a law firm and also professional staff who I think it's proper to say, Mr. Speaker, were not compensated in any fashion at the time. There may have been an expectation on their part, or maybe not, that they might be compensated if funding did actually come through in the settlement. It did come through, and so this board has previously voted to authorize Speaker Benz to evaluate the costs of the services provided prior to the appropriation and to make a recommendation of the board. We've discussed this before, but Speaker Benz is, I believe, here today with a report and a recommendation, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Beginning in October of 2015, we received, the state of Florida began receiving not money, but an approval of a settlement agreement between BP and the state of Florida. While Tribe Gulf Coast had been formed statutorily a couple of years before that, once the deal was made, it was serious. And at that point in time, the Triumph Board had informally asked me to be chairman, and while for the first year or so we did very little, once the settlement was agreed to, we had to get in action, we had to start. So I brought on board, I talked Susan Skelton into coming on board. Susan's been around, we've said this at many board meetings before, the process for 20 to 30 years. Actually, she headed up the Taxation and Budget Reform Commission staffer back in 2008 and is invaluable. She understands the process and is very, very, very well organized. She's been working for free up until we formally were incorporated in 2017, almost 2 years later. And I asked her to please give me a summary of the time she spent. She discounted her fees a lot. The amount to pay her for the 2 years almost of work is $103,944. At the same time, I also hired legal counsel because we were getting, again, pretty serious working with the legislature on a regular basis. And we hired the firm of Burke & Blue to do work for us. Based upon the recommendation of the board, I asked them to give us a bill as well. Their bill for roughly the same time frame is $90,335. Having said that, I can tell you that for 2 years, Susan Skelton harassed me. I should arrest her for stalking. I mean, when the legislature was in session, she was on me every day. You got to call so-and-so. You got to work this, do that. And not that the legislature wasn't capable. It's just that we were living Triumph every day. The 160 members of the legislature don't have time to get involved in one issue like that. So we were very involved in it, as were many of the board members that are here today. So having said that, You charged me with getting an invoice from them. I reviewed the invoices from each of those two parties. And I will tell you, too, Lisa Walters was on me hard. I see Susan was. Man, I got hit double whammy every day for a long time. But it's all good. The legislation passed, and we have $300 million in the bank, frankly, thanks to a lot of their efforts. So, Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that these two invoices be paid by Gulf Coast Triumph. Triumph Gulf Coast. I don't know if you would like for that to be in a motion. It's your call, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, why don't we ask if there are any questions? Any comment from our treasurer?
Yeah, I would say I concur with you on reimbursing some of these expenditures, because had we been operating with the cash, we would have incurred certain expenditures as time went on. We laid a lot of groundwork to get us to this point, so we could start accepting pre-applications as early on as we have. If we had not started this process when we did, it would have set us back, you know, a substantial amount of time. So I'm in favor of reimbursing Burke and Blue and Ms. Skelton for their costs incurred.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could also add, we sent a letter to the Attorney General of Florida asking just to wear belt and suspenders if it was okay if we made these expenditures. And General Bondi said yes. So I think we've done sufficient homework to make sure that we're acting according to Florida statutes.
Thank you, Speaker. Are there any other questions? Is there debate? Any debate? Is there objection? Does any member object? If not, show it adopted. And now let's move on to a presentation by Dr. Harper. Excuse me. As Susan indicated, Dr. Harper is the leading business economist, certainly in Northwest Florida, and many believe in Florida. I can tell you, just by way of introduction, that when we passed the Oil Spill Recovery Act, it came in two pieces. The first was at, is that your introductory music, Dr. Harper? Is that Scott Remington's way of saying goodbye? Yeah, at least you're here, so.
Bye-bye. We got put on hold.
Yeah. There were two pieces to the Oil Spill Recovery Act that was passed by the Florida legislature. The first piece was an appropriation from the state's general revenues of $30 million to be a kind of pump primer immediately after the oil spill to help infuse the area with new economic activity and new jobs. Dr. Harper was placed by the legislature in charge of that. He administered that that program. In my recollection, he'll correct me if I'm wrong, it's a $30 million program, and it created 7,000 high-paying jobs, jobs that we're very proud to have and still have. And moreover, the cost per job was less than $4,000 per job, which I think Corey can probably affirm is substantially less than other economic development projects in the state of Florida. Second part, of course, of the Oil Spill Recovery Act was, as Speaker Benz indicated, the provision of three-fourths of the economic damages agreed to by the federal courts and by BP to be expended through Triumph Gulf Coast. Dr. Harper has now agreed to be our economic advisor on this larger part of the project. We welcome him. And Dr. Harper, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and directors. It's a pleasure to be a part of the Triumph team. It was bittersweet, of course, to retire from the University of West Florida in December, but I'm delighted to have been able to join the Triumph team subsequent to that. And you've asked me, Mr. Chairman, to comment briefly on the project and what is economic activity, what is economic impact, and how might that relate to some of the projects that are proposed to the board for their consideration, and what are some of the decision criteria that would go into forming an opinion about whether these are, in fact, the best projects that we would see from the geographies around the region, and also, are we seeing the best projects that we might reasonably expect to see over the next number of years as the Triumph program moves forward. BP is, of course, responsible for 18 payments, for 15 payments over 18 years, and those hopefully will come in without being allocated to other uses in the future. I guess the first thing to say is that BP has spent over $60 billion on the Deepwater Horizon disaster. The component that we here in Triumph deal with is the $1.5 billion that was allocated by the legislature of the state of Florida to be spent in the eight coastal counties. It is not subject to federal jurisdiction in the same way that the restore dollars are, that the natural resource defense assessment dollars, the NERDA dollars are, or the NIFWIF dollars or other dollars. Instead, this is entirely under state jurisdiction, and as such, it represents the economic damages claim that General Bondi pursued against BP. The settlement that was agreed to as part of the global settlement by Attorney General Holder in 2015 resulted in a $2 billion settlement for the state of Florida versus $1 billion for Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and that really reflects the size of Florida's economy, the damage that was suffered primarily in terms of lost sales and use tax, far and away the largest damage component to the state of Florida. And with that in mind, the legislature specified that these dollars were to be used for programs and projects which generate maximum economic benefit. That's not to say that environmental issues have no play in the Triumph Awards. The legislature did specify that as one of the criteria to be used in considering whether to make an award, projects that bring environmental benefits in addition to economic benefits would be considered. However, it seems clear that the intent of the legislation is to fund projects that generate, as the legislation says, maximum estimated economic benefits. And to calculate maximum estimated economic benefits over time, the legislature provided several additional criteria, such as projects that would increase household income, projects that, of course, would leverage regional assets. And if you look at the way economic development happens and economic activity, I think it's fair to say that economic development is all about matching our region's productive assets to needs out there in the marketplace. And so, if we think about how to earn higher incomes and generate maximum benefits, certainly the way that we do it on the supply side of that equation, assuming that we can't influence the national marketplace for the things that we do produce and sell, the way to influence our productivity and to raise household incomes and generate maximum economic benefits is to build the quality of the assets which go into the productive process in Northwest Florida. And those productive assets include everything from the quality and skills of our labor force and the children that will enter the labor force in the coming years. And the legislation specifies that, in fact, the language that's used in the Career and Professional Education Act of several years ago, educational programs that provide our youngsters with certifiable skills, industry certified skills, other educational programs that provide them with transferable workplace skills are to be considered. And of course, and then we see improving assets such as the infrastructure assets that our region has available. And those infrastructure assets that work in concert with our labor force, our human assets, could include things such as roads that lower the cost of doing business, providing better access to key area productive assets. They could include things such as water projects that improve the ability of our businesses to provide products to the marketplace using productive assets to produce those goods more efficiently and in a sustainable advantage fashion. So the economic development that we seek to encourage here is about improving assets in our region. Those assets could come in a variety of shapes and forms. However, it's important for the board to consider that also there may be applications that come before you from eligible entities for projects that are deemed to be public infrastructure and thus may meet the letter of the statute. However, it seems clear that the intent of this legislation that governs our activities are to pick among those projects which actually maximize economic activity. And here I would make a distinction between projects that are perfectly desirable and beneficial for our community that might include assets that we think of as quality of life enhancing assets. I've certainly heard members of the board refer to particular projects that might well enhance the quality of recreation, whether those are ballparks or whether they are boat ramps or whether they are art in public places that may well be considered to be public infrastructure. However, in terms of calculating the maximum economic benefit generated, it's important to think in terms of those infrastructure projects and other projects that will lead to sustainable economic activity through time. Every project that proposes to spend $100,000 or $1 million will generate immediate economic impact as that money is spent. Some of those projects would generate more economic impact immediately spending Triumph dollars than others. Projects which have a high local component, which have a high value of local match so that the overall project can be bigger and leverage Triumph dollars, will tend to have higher calculated return on investment for the value of the project that they propose, whereas projects that propose immediate spending that perhaps does not use local assets. You could think of a project that proposes to purchase a fire engine constructed in Detroit using $500,000. Well, the part of that that stays locally in our economy may be very small. Perhaps only the dealer commission would stay in our local economy. The rest of it might flow off to finance the wages of workers who put that machine together in a factory far away. There are some differences between the local projects in their immediate impact, but any project that proposes to spend Triumph dollars will have an immediate impact that might range from relatively modest to somewhat larger. Importantly, when you consider spending a Triumph dollar, whether that slice of dollars is $100,000 or $1 million or $10 million, the important thing to consider when looking at benefits and costs is what would you have done with that money otherwise? Because that's the true cost of the project. If you hadn't spent that $500,000 on a water main or a road improvement or a fire engine, what would you have spent it on? Well, the answer is the balance of projects which will come before you in this round of applications and the projects which will come before you in subsequent rounds of applications. That's the real opportunity cost. That's what you're giving up by spending a dollar today versus saving it and keeping your powder dry, as it were, to spend that dollar at some point down the road. And so the board has an important decision to make in terms of whether you feel, and of course staff will work to advise and support you in your thinking as you proceed. Have you seen some of the very best projects that are likely to come before you, and therefore the board should spend a lot of money in the early going and get some base hits, some extra base hits, maybe even some home runs, or should the board keep its powder dry, thinking that perhaps some of the best projects to come are still waiting on the sidelines to see exactly what this application process looks like? Now, having said that about the immediate impact of projects, the ones which will score highest in terms of the overall contribution to economic activity of a particular project are the ones that generate sustainable economic activity. And so these would be projects that contribute to building a base for future economic activity that is net new to the region. And it's in, so we all understand the concept of future economic activity and jobs and local economic product and spending, you know, the local analog of gross domestic product, so local spending. However, what we know from our economic development experience, and all of you certainly have experience in evaluating various economic development proposals, is that by and large, projects which bring net new activity, activity which would not have existed absent the project, are going to be the ones that score most highly. Therefore, even though it may be highly desirable to have a new clinic in a town, that is activity which perhaps would have occurred in the absence of Triumph spending, because those are services that are based on local demand. They are not nationally traded sectors. Instead, they are locally traded sectors where people spend at their local grocery store, where they spend at their local restaurant, where they spend at their local retail outlet. For instance, Mr. President, I've certainly told you before about a project that came before the $30 million fund that the legislature initially asked our office when I was at the University of Florida, West Florida, to administer, that was from a local restaurateur. An excellent business person, was running a successful business, and wanted to put a better parking lot next to their building. Well, the requirement traditionally in incentivizing economic activity was that economic development incentives, such as Triumph dollars, should not be put towards buying market share for an existing local competitor that would come at the expense of other local competitors. Therefore, the projects which generate the highest net new, that is, very new to the region, wouldn't have arisen just through the natural supply process of saying, do we need another substation here to serve the population? Do we need another doctor at this clinic to serve the needs of the population? Do we need another restaurant because it can be supported? Those will not generate net new economic activity. Instead, they're just part of the spin-off process, the ripple effect, the multiplier effect of new export industries. And those export industries exporting from our region do not have to be traditional manufactured goods. Certainly in the last several years, a major financial services firm in Pensacola has worked with Enterprise Florida to receive economic development incentives. They provide financial services. They provide mortgage assistance for families around the country and, in fact, around the globe. But they are an export industry because their activities are financed by the origination fees generated by those mortgage applications from Florida, from Alaska, from Japan. And so they are an export industry. They bring income from abroad to support payroll that occurs here in our affected region. So the projects that score the highest will be those that generate net new economic activity, whether manufacturing or services. And so those are the projects that we will be looking for and will score the highest. Board members have mentioned in previous meetings they want to see that Triumph dollars are the last dollars in. Well, what that means, it's not necessarily a calendar term that they're the last ones to be added to a project from a calendar sense, but rather that the Triumph dollars are, as Scott Remington would say, dispositive. They are the things that put the project over the top. That there's perhaps 90 cents of other match out there, but the Triumph are the 10 missing cents that helps put the project over the top. So high-impact projects will show Triumph dollars as the last dollars in because they have a high level of match. And we've talked about what that match might be. In my conversations, board members have indicated that it's important that that match, it could have occurred last year even, as long as the match is seamless. Seamless being the operative word here. That match could have been contributed by a county in terms of planning expenses for a road or a sewer project. But, and they're asking Triumph for dollars to finish that project. Well, is it appropriate to say you can't count those earlier dollars because they were already expended? The Triumph dollars are not going to encourage new spending. That part of the spending's already been done. However, so as to not disadvantage projects which the county government or the local government or the other entity that's eligible has done spending on already, it seems appropriate to count match that is in fact seamless. That if it's clearly part of that project, clearly needed to bring it from phase one through phase four, if that's what's needed, then yes, it would be appropriate to count that match rather than dismissing it out of hand by saying that's already been expended, Triumph doesn't need to subsidize that. So we talked about lasting and sustainable impact on economic activity, something that leverages existing strengths in regional assets is particularly attractive. Florida's Great Northwest, working with the University of West Florida Haas Center and other partners such as TIP Strategies, a consulting firm out of Austin, Texas, recently produced a regional economic strategy document that identified through data analysis using nationally accepted techniques what some of the relevant clusters in Northwest Florida are. They include things such as water transportation. One only need think of Eastern Shipbuilding as a dominant force in water transportation. They include cybersecurity, and one need only think of the National Security Administration activities at Quarry Station in Pensacola as driving that cluster. A weakness that we have, because we're only about 1 million population through the eight counties, is that many of our identified clusters tend to only have one or two firms in them. However, to the extent that we can leverage those existing assets that have led to an identified cluster, where a cluster is identified as having a lot more employment density here in our region in that sector than would be expected if we looked like the national average, well, perhaps we can support those activities by looking at incentivizing activities which support that regional cluster. Perhaps not a firm specifically, but rather the needs in terms of labor market training for specific occupations that are typically employed in that cluster. Those sorts of things would score higher on economic activity. We've talked about the role of traded clusters versus non-traded local clusters and the importance that they carry. Well, what would be some things that would lead to a low calculated return on investment, low calculated return measured as economic activity? Well, projects that promote quality of life rather than promoting economic activity. Although they're desirable for the community, they might not be the sorts of projects that the directors would wish to fund. Projects which duplicate existing programs. If that same program exists and there are facilities 10 miles down the road or a program 50 miles down the road, that might be a factor that the board wishes to take into account if that capacity already exists within our region. What if it's a project that takes assets off the tax rolls and instead shifts them into the public sector? Would that be a sort of project that would lead to lower economic activity? I would suggest that the board would consider projects which in fact grow the capacity of municipal government via increasing the private sector participation. Does a project displace existing private sector capacity? Do we want to be in the business of perhaps building new infrastructure or other sorts of equipment capacity if that capacity exists in a reasonably competitive private marketplace already? Do we want to displace the private sector? To me, that would lead to a lower scoring project. A low scoring project would include one that clearly would have occurred without Triumph Gulf Coast dollars. And Mr. Chairman, you mentioned in a recent meeting, we need to consider, are Triumph dollars supplementing or are they supplanting? And certainly a project which supplements rather than supplants funding would have a better economic impact. Projects which have a low level of match, other things equal, would lead to lower overall project expenditures both in the near term and over the long term. And so projects with a low level of match would be calculated to have a lower economic impact. And so that's a brief introduction to the way that we ought to consider projects that meet the priorities for economic recovery, diversification, enhancement, and generate maximum estimated economic benefits. And that's my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman and Board.
Thank you, Dr. Harper. And before we move forward into how we apply those constructs to the process we have in front of us, the pre-apps that we have in hand, are there any questions for Dr. Harper about how we think about economic diversification and development projects and how they would be scored? If not, I understand, Ms. Henderson, that you may have the football at this point, and you can talk to us where we are now. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, we have received a large number of pre-applications. Based on a conversation at a previous board meeting, professional staff has been requested to begin to sort those applications as a first sort, those that appear to meet statutory criteria. Based on our understanding of that criteria, as Mr. Remington mentioned, we have a letter in to presiding officers requesting additional clarification if they choose to give it to us. And those projects that on their face appear to meet statutory criteria, the ones that do, the ones that don't, as a first sort, before we get into the economic analysis itself. And based on that request to staff, where are we now, Ms. Henderson?
Good afternoon, and I look forward to working with you all. We have, as a team, reviewed 116 pre-applications, and we very carefully read what the pre-applicants provided to us in their description and used that to evaluate whether they were eligible under the 7 award criteria found in the statute, as we understand the award criteria to be. And as Dr. Harper mentioned, we didn't really look at the economic analysis because the majority of the pre-applications didn't contain information for us to do that. So we looked at it on face value of the information provided. To help kind of illustrate how we came to the list before you that don't seem to meet the eligibility criteria, project number 9 is a good place to start. It is the Florida Community Service Corporation of Walton County, Phase 1, U.S. 133 Water Transmission Line. And it's project number 9, and it was top ranked by Walton County. And the project may very well have economic value for Walton County and the City of Freeport by providing additional water supply to allow for the growth of potential industrial areas. But based on the information provided in the pre-application, it wasn't clear to us that the infrastructure could be considered public. We could envision a viable application for this project and this type of a project where the applicant and the county showed a formal relationship, where the county was willing to be a participant in the contract terms and negotiation, and that might help the project to become more eligible and allow for the time for Dr. Harper to look at what the return would be.
And excuse me, Ms. Henderson, but are you referring, illustrating that project, to refer to the statutory language that says that we need to be about the business of public infrastructure?
Yes, I apologize. That was the public infrastructure is the first words in the infrastructure discussion in the award criteria. And so we really tried to understand what the intent of the language as we currently understand it. And another one that showcases public, the hang-up on the public infrastructure question, is projects number 92 and 93. They are both submitted by the Panacea Oyster Co-op in Wakulla, and they are really great examples of what could be excellent proposals to grow existing industry in a rural community. And again, they meet many of the priority considerations also in the statute and the discretionary considerations that you all have discussed oftentimes. However, they don't appear to meet the public infrastructure statement in the statute. And so that is the reason they're on the not eligible at this time list. As staff, we do look forward to the opportunity to explore with them, as well as a lot of the other applicants who may not understand how we came to that decision, how we got there. And we both look forward, Dr. Harper and I look forward to determining that with them. Education.
And Ms. Anderson, yeah. A question from Dr. Dan.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Corey. So when you're reviewing these pre-applications, you're looking at these pre-apps with a lens of what the statute says. You're not using any discretionary, no discretion, correct?
Correct. That was our first pass, was to see. We don't want people to spend time working towards something that's not going to meet the statute. We'd rather have them have the opportunity to re-propose their proposal or to recognize that it just doesn't meet the spirit of the statute. And Dr. Herbert can elaborate.
And to add briefly to that, we did not ask in the pre-application for any of the potential economic impact criteria. We didn't ask pre-applicants to describe to what extent their project would generate maximum economic benefit or associated employment. We asked for a 3-page executive summary, and the intent of that, of course, is to determine whether it fits in one of the 7 buckets that the legislature specified as potentially eligible uses. So for the projects, as Corey mentioned, that may well have a very straightforward fix to create a project. And of course, the largest category of projects that were not initially able to be determined to be eligible was because they proposed infrastructure that we could not determine to be public infrastructure in nature. Now, the next step, of course, will be to work with those applicants to see a way to, or are open to seeing a way to overcoming that shortcoming, and then to ask them for the specific information that is needed to determine whether they are a low return on investment project or a high return on investment project. The initial screen is simply an eligibility screen based on the criteria as specified by the legislature.
Thank you. That was helpful.
Please continue, Ms. Anderson.
I can discuss the next steps at this time, or we can continue to answer questions.
Any other questions right now, Mr. Connolly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So certainly we're going to be talking about this in light of the statute as it's read today and as you interpreted it fairly absolutely. The letter that we've sent the presiding officers seeks to clarify that intent and therefore some discretion, I would say, with the reading of the statute. Am I hearing you say that thus far, though, this is strictly based on the statute as we read it today, not in light of the clarifications we're getting from the presiding officers?
Correct.
Okay. So we don't know when we're going to get that is part of our issue. So
we don't know when, and we don't know in what context it may come. Speaker Benz knows far better than me. There is no such thing as legislative intent. There's the clear reading of the law. But we can ask presiding officers for their personal guidance so that as we face our own internal audits, as we face the audit of the Auditor General, when we're asked questions about why we awarded funds to certain projects and not other projects, I think it helps to have as much plainting as we possibly can. But as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the first sort was not based on economic analysis or return on investment. It was based on there's some projects here that may be very worthwhile projects but don't fall within the categories laid out in the statute. And there are some that may not fall based on, as you say, a strict reading of the statute, but if the projects were modified in some way, they might.
So
any other questions at this point for Ms. Anderson or Dr. Harper? If not, why don't you proceed?
Okay. So for our next steps, which is a question we have received often, Dr. Harper and I do look forward to meeting and talking with the pre-applicants as they go through their application process. We recognize that this is the first time anybody has done this. It's a brand new application, and there will be hiccups in along the way, understanding what's being asked for in the application. And so we'll work together to refine that process and work with the applicants to understand what's being asked of them so that Dr. Harper can perform his economic analysis. And so we can make sure that it meets the criteria and also your discretionary criteria that you've all laid out very clearly. We encourage the participants, the applicants, to take necessary time to be thoughtful and gather appropriate data. And we expect that some applicants will be able to do this pretty quickly because they apply for grants more regularly. But for the most part, we expect the timeline to be about 45 days to see the bulk of the applications start to come in. And we would like to encourage applicants, I would like to encourage applicants to consider their scope of work and how their deliverables will be measured as they develop their applications. The board, you've made it very clear, and the statute is clear, that there are achievable, that metrics are necessary. And so we would like applicants to think about that as they are creating their proposals and their applications. Another topic that has come up has been assistance for our rural communities and rural applicants. And I have been speaking with both Enterprise Florida and the Department of Opportunity, and they are both open to assisting where they can, and I will facilitate those introductions where appropriate so that everybody's expectations can be clear. And also to continue to collaborate so that the Triumph dollars can be maximized based on what else is already available in the communities.
Ms. Henderson, if we could stop there for a second. I know one of the concerns that has come up from the board is as we get into this process, we recognize there's a distinction. It may not be a fair distinction, but there's a distinction between larger counties that have well-established economic development offices within their county government, who are used to, as you point out, applying for funds for economic development. And then there are other counties who, because of the size of the county, their small tax base, you know, they run a county government that's lean and efficient, and, you know, they don't have a big economic development office with five people working in it. And we want to make sure that they're treated equitably and fairly. So, Ms. Skelton, I know that this is something on behalf of the board that you've begun to look into, and Mr. Remington's begun to look into, and now our new professional staff. Could you remark to this a little bit?
Yes, sir. Several months ago, this issue was discussed at the behest of Mr. Schoaf. He brought the issue before the board and directed Mr. Remington to reach out to the rural counties that qualified for the rural infrastructure funds to find out if those counties were able to or had been able to participate in the planning dollar part of the rural infrastructure fund capability. And he sent letters, Mr. Remington did, to each of the counties and the localities that were eligible for the rural infrastructure fund dollars. And we have not received responses back from those local areas, but in the interim, Corey has reached out to the Rural Infrastructure Fund staff, and they've begun exploring possibilities. While it might not be those exact planning dollars, they're looking for ways to facilitate assistance to the local rural areas that would be impacted, as you're discussing, the ones that don't have the large economic development teams and offices in place, to help them through the process and to do everything that we can to make that process as simplified as possible. Dr. Harper and EFI can help them with some of the modeling that may need to be done, but we will make every effort to reach out to the areas because we do recognize that we do have a mix of counties here, and we have some, and governments, and we have some that are not to the same level as, for example, in Escambia or a Bay County. So we've begun that process, we continue that process, and we're committed to make sure that we don't leave anybody behind in the process.
And Ms. Henderson, when you talk about 45 days, I saw a whole bunch of heads go down and write that down as if that was some magical deadline that something's going to happen in 45 days, but couldn't happen on the 46th day. So could you explain what you meant by that?
Sure. I apologize. We just took a look at the application and thought about the data that would need to be collected, and from our own personal experiences, thought that was an amount of time that you could expect as a board to see applications come in. I don't think that's any indication for the applicants on when their applications should come in. There's actually one pre-application in there where there's a community who is working with DEO already on research related to that facility. So we would encourage them to wait for that to come back, that report to come back, so that they could have the most up-to-date data in their application, even if that takes 6 months. We're just trying to, that 45 days was just for the board to have an idea, not necessarily to see these all in 2 weeks.
Yes, sir. Mr. Riggs.
I have one question regarding our application process. I assume you've had a chance to review the application process, and to sort of piggyback off of what we asked for in the pre-application process, is what we're asking for in our application process sufficient for you to be able to analyze what you need for these projects, or are there any alterations or changes that you would like to see the application process to mitigate some of the back and forth that goes on between yourself and the applicant, and or helps you score these in the manner that you see fit? Because, you know, we tried to get this process started as soon as possible before we had the luxury of having you on board.
Thank you, Director Riggs. Yes, the project application as constructed does contain reference to the information that's necessary. It contains reference to the economic activity that's projected to result from the activity. Now, admittedly, that probably doesn't appear in 14-point boldface as it would need to indicate what are the most important responses on the application. However, the question is in there, and we recognize, Corey and Susan and others recognize that for entities that don't have a lot of experience in pursuing grant funding applications that are primarily economic activity oriented, will your application generate additional economic activity in the region? There may be some questions about how to handle that. So the answer to your question, Director Riggs, is that yes, the questions are in there, and I have every expectation that it will require discussion as to how to flesh those out. I believe that conceptually it is fairly straightforward. However, it's not a way of thinking that most people engage in on a day-to-day basis.
Mr. Connolly.
So I know we're bouncing around here a bit with y'all. Thank you for your work you've put into this already. One of the things I just want to be sure you kept on your radar screen here in the next few weeks, and we've talked about this as a board, I think Dr. Dana mentioned this several times, as we talked about bringing in supplemental subject matter experts on some elements of what we're looking at in the application base. I'll note that I personally, as I looked through the pre-apps, saw a number of applications in the workforce training space. And we expected that. We asked for that. It's clearly, I think, an area that we have some interest in, and the statute allows us to make some investments in. What's also clear to me, though, is that there can be and probably is some duplication across multiple proposals. And I'm not going to sit here and try to articulate what I interpret to be duplication or not. I think some of that is subjective. But I would suggest that now's the time for us to think strategically about making sure any workforce investments we make are thought through for the long term, and that, for instance, 2 years from now, we're not hearing from other applicants wanting to do these same things, and we're telling them, no, we've already done that. And that's an acceptable answer, but I think it just needs to be in the context of a larger regional workforce strategy. Workforce development strategy. Mm-hmm. I know every one of these has its merits, and I know every applicant that put them together can articulate those merits. I just want us on the front end to think strategically and make sure we're not duplicating our investments and then therefore maximizing our investments over the long run. And that, you know, workforce development and training to me is an example of that. There may be others in this pile of applications that we want to go ahead and bring in those early subject matter experts. But for me, that's one in particular, Mr. Chairman, that I think would be good for us as a board to see happen early on.
Thank you. Any other comments at this point? I'd like to put, you know, maybe a blunt kind of, ordinary guy's point on this whole thing about smaller communities, smaller counties. I happen to live in a county that's listed as one of the smaller counties. I guess here's my concern. I want to make sure that there is no good idea, no idea that seems to have the potential for real economic impact, positive economic impact, that gets lost in the shuffle because it doesn't come in leather-bound with fancy-schmancy exhibits and lots of economic lingo. Instead, I want to make doggone sure that if there is someone who has an idea that seems to have promise, that we will not just sit passively and wait for them to mature the idea, but rather that we reach out and say, you've sent something in, part of this may not meet the statutory criteria, part of it might, part of it may not have a significant return on investment. There's something here that might, and we want to help you get your proposal to the place where it can be evaluated fairly. And I know that we've had an offer from Enterprise Florida to help applicants develop projects. We've had offers from others. Ms. Skelton has indicated there may be planning dollars available. I guess to be real blunt about it, I don't want this to become a relief act for out-of-town consultants who say the only way that you can get Triumph dollars is by hiring me for $50,000. That would be a failure in my view. And I don't know if my colleagues share this view or if they disagree, if I'm in a minority position, but I wanted to articulate that and ask my colleagues if they had any comments, and then ask our professional advisors. Mr. Speaker, any thoughts there?
No, I agree with you 100%, Don. Just because you're from a rural county should not preclude you from having access to good folks. Enterprise Florida has been kind to offer up their services, and thank you, Stan Connolly, and Senator Gates for doing that. Having said that, let's look at the larger picture. I reviewed almost all these applicants from Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I will tell you that in many, many cases, I saw Triumph as supplanting city, county, and state responsibilities. We're not here to fix leaky pipes. I will tell you, the one example, I forget where it was, where we run stormwater and water lines to a future Commerce Park. No, that's the field of dreams, man. Those happen rarely. I think everything we do needs to be tied, hopefully directly, to economic activity. What kind of impact will this job, will this project have to bring new jobs to our area? How can we improve infrastructure to increase and diversify our economy? I want to look at salaries. I saw a few applications where it looked like some folks were going to get some nice salaries. I want to know how much the CEOs are getting paid on these projects. I think it's really important that we all look at that. Number one, if it's astronomical, it's embarrassing to us, and you're going to be mad about it, and I would be mad as well. You know, in 2007 to 2010, the federal government and state governments and local governments to a certain extent decided to spend a lot of money to create jobs right then. And we needed them, and a lot of them worked. I'm not criticizing what happened. My vision of Triumph is not to create one-year construction jobs or two-year construction jobs. That's not, if it creates 50 one-year construction jobs, that's not what drives me. What drives me is going to be what kind of impact will this project have on increasing and enhancing the economic activity of that area, or the entire area. So I can tell you there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of money that's been asked for that we don't have. I would suggest, and I'm just one vote, and I'm being very blunt, I understand that, but I want y'all to know how one member of this committee is going to be, and that is, I'm going to be very skeptical if you are using money to do infrastructure work in your community that you should be doing. If you want it because it will help bring an industry to your area or expand existing industries or enhance the overall area in terms of creating jobs, you got my attention. You got my attention then. So I know you're probably mad. A lot of you folks are. But that's just, Mr. Chairman, you asked me my opinion, and I happen to give it to you.
Thank you, Speaker. Dr. Dana, were you seeking recognition?
No, I wasn't. I just agreed with your earlier comments. Thank you.
Any other comments at this point? If not, Ms. Anderson, did you have anything further? Dr. Harper.
No, I think we would both agree, Dr. Harper and I, that we look forward to being a partner with the applicants and the communities and you as a board so that the result is something everybody can be proud of.
Can you walk us through? I'm sorry, Dr. Dana, please.
I was just going to ask Corey, in this process, do the applicants reach out to you directly for requests for assistance, or are you reaching out to them? How is this going to work?
I think it will be a combination. As Susan mentioned, we almost have phone numbers, and so I think it will be much easier once we have phone numbers on the website. In the meantime, info@myfloridatriumph.com is the best way to get to all of us, and then we will sort through the best way to respond, whether it's an in-person meeting, sometimes a phone call works, and we'll work to coordinate that, just kind of both directions.
And is it my understanding that subject to the actions of this board at this meeting,
there'll be letters.
Susan intends that letters would be sent out to all of those from whom we've received pre-apps to reach out to them to say, based on what we know now, here's where you stand with respect to the statutory criteria. Please contact us. We want to talk to you. So I would hope, Dr. Dana, that the answer to that question is, if you don't call us, we'll call you.
Correct. And yes, everybody will receive a letter, and there will be contact information in the letter, and they will be, many of them will be individualized to ones that we really have a lot of questions for.
And if we see that we need more assistance in reaching out to people, then we'll ask the board for more help, and we also, as I said, have the offer of help from other agencies.
Senator.
Yes, Susan.
Mr. Chairman, to your point on the rural infrastructure issues, we actually have, and I'm not going to specifically name a project because I don't want to do that to localize it, but basically we've already identified one or two projects where they might not have met the test had they been in Escambia County, but because of the nature of the project and the type of training that's involved in the project, that it made it into the pile to go forward because of its rural locality. And we are specifically very sensitive to that issue because we understand that the legislature has put forward a requirement that a certain amount of money must be spent in each of the eight counties over the period. And we want to be sure that the projects that go to, particularly to those counties where there may not get a lot more bite at the apple, that the projects that go there are quality projects that are sound and meet the criteria that Dr. Harper has spoken to today.
Any other comments at this point? Could you walk us through then, Corey and Dr. Harper, what are the next steps? What happens tomorrow, assuming the board doesn't take any action that would direct you otherwise? What is your what happens tomorrow? What happens next week, next month? How will you operate?
Well, we will begin sending out letters. If the contact information in your pre-application is not who you intend to receive communications, definitely please let us know. And at that point, we'll also begin setting up phone calls and meetings to with applicants and pre-applicants to discuss the information. Some may choose to change their application entirely. Others may determine that it's not time to go forward, and we respect that as well. So we'll continue to, we'll begin to meet and talk through the application itself. You may want to add.
That's correct. And of course, the application itself asks for quantitative evidence demonstrating how the proposed project or program will promote economic recovery, diversification, and enhancement. So it asks specifically for the applicant's perception of what the economic activity contribution of the project is going to be. It asks the applicant to explain how the project is considered transformational and what the impacts on the disproportionately affected counties will be in the next 10 years. Ask them to describe data or information to demonstrate the viability. And so in those questions and in those responses is where I anticipate finding the information that we will need to work with the client and go down the road of calculating return on investment. There may be questions for particular applicants indicating staff's desire to have that spelled out at some level of detail, but each applicant will receive a letter stating that it appears that they meet the eligibility requirements and asking them, inviting them to submit their full application should they choose to do so. And at that point, we ask them for their impact information.
Okay, two questions. One, let's imagine that somebody looks at that application and says, I wonder what that question means. What is it really seeking to draw out of me? Can they consult with you? Can they ask you? Will you direct them to perhaps other applications that have been funded in the past, either by the $30 million fund that you administered, Dr. Harper, or by Enterprise Florida, to let them know the language to speak and how to answer questions about economic impact?
Yes, I expect to have that conversation a lot over the next several weeks. Every one of these proposals was submitted by a group that has the region's best interests at heart. They should be taken very seriously as proposals which seek to improve the quality of our region economically. And with that in mind, I'll work to help the applicants understand how best to portray their project in a way that fully and aptly describes how it could be transformative for the region. So yes, that's, I think, something that a person learns only after having either Corey's or my experience or some of your experience in working with this type of project or in understanding economic impact and calculating economic impact. So no, it's not something that I think that project applicants can generally do a good job of on their own necessarily, nor do I think it is something that should move potential applicants to go out and spend a lot of money on a high-powered consultant, because we're going to be looking for the same information in a $50,000 consulting report as we are in a 15-minute phone conversation with the applicant.
Okay, and then secondly, Dr. Harper, if you, I don't mean to make you take us inside every nuance, but when you say you're going to be calculating return on investment and economic impact, could you acquaint the board with the arrangements that you've made to use the REMI model, with whom you've made those arrangements, how that will work, and just a general description of the model that you will be using to give advice to the board about these projects?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The statute calls for providing priority consideration to projects that generate maximum estimated economic benefits based on tools and models not generally employed by economic input-output analyses, including cost-benefit, return on investment, or dynamic scoring techniques to determine how the long-term economic growth potential of the counties may be enhanced by the investment. And what that means, in layperson speak, is that you should not just say that this $1 million expenditure has this particular impact in the immediate term, but it has no lasting impact on the economy. That's what dynamic scoring is all about. Our federal government uses dynamic scoring when it looks at tax bills, for example, and calculates that if there will be additional economic activity generated by a tax cut, then that additional activity generates its own tax revenue. And that's what's meant by dynamic scoring. And so to calculate these impacts, economists typically use models that incorporate the economic structure that underpins the economy. That is the standard, how much do you need of these inputs to make such and such amount of that output, an input-output model, but also that calculate what will be the effect of that spending on wage rates in the region. Will it suck up all the available labor force and have an impact on wages that way? Will it create occupational demands that then ripple through to educational institutions? And so that's what's meant by looking at dynamic scoring. And then we are asked to look at cost benefit and return on investment. Those are metrics which generally are expressed as ratios, that the return on investment on a project might be 10% or 20%, and certainly your accounting department might talk to you about the internal rate of return. And so these concepts are intended to divorce the award of the project from the calculation of its benefit. It may be that a project that requests, because it's a rural county and can't absorb $10 million worth of spending productively, perhaps it only asks for $100,000, and yet that $100,000 gets you a big bang on your buck. That's a return on investment, a cost-benefit calculation, and so it could be that a project that proposes to only spend $100,000 could have a better return on investment measure than a project which proposes to spend $10 million, even though the $10 million project generates 1,000 jobs and the $100,000 project only generates 6 jobs. And so we look at ratios, we look at dynamic, kind of all the economy together interacting. That's called a general equilibrium model. And so to do that, West Florida Regional Planning Council has offered that if I would give their staff some training as a quid pro quo on how to use a particular product that's available that is kind of the gold standard in commercially available softwares. It's quite expensive, but the RPCs around the state pool their money and subscribe to Regional Economic Models, Inc., REMI is the acronym, and so I will train their workers, not on looking at these projects, but rather on looking at projects that they have before them for their own use, to show them how to use those tools, what those tools give you, what you can infer from the numbers you get, what you can't infer from the numbers that you get. And they have determined that that will meet their licensing criteria. I will be able to download that software onto my own computer so that no one except me, as well as the Triumph team, will have access to those particular calculations. They will not be accessible to West Florida Regional Planning Council, for example. And so they will be confidential to the extent required by law. And that's the software that I intend to use to do these calculations. And of course, you know, using the economic intuition garnered from more than a couple of decades doing this sort of work, that determines the input numbers. And so I intend to use that expertise to work with the clients to generate the input numbers that will then be used in a standard fashion to generate projected ratios of return on investment and economic impact.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Billheimer, it's our understanding that you and Mr. Remington have reviewed this notion of a quid pro quo with the West Florida Regional Planning Council, whereby we would have access to their REMI models, and you have found that there is no problem with that. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
All right. Any other comments about how Dr. Harper's analysis works?
I've got one. Jeremy.
Yes, sir, Mr. Lee.
Just kind of looking at ROI and, you know, and heard you mention it several times, and also available workforce. If we've got a project that's going to bring in, we don't have available workforce for right now, is that project going to be treated any differently than a project that we do have available workforce? We're right now, our workforce in some counties is very limited. So the finding people to fill those jobs is going to be difficult. So how do you look at that?
Director Lee, I think that comment is absolutely germane, and that in areas where there is high projected occupational demand, yet we do not have sufficient supply of qualified candidates with that training, that clearly creates a shortage in the marketplace for people with that skill, and that would generate a higher return, being able to then provide people to perform that particular occupation in an area that has a demonstrated need, than would a project to train similarly qualified individuals to get a similar qualification in an area where those skills were already available in abundance. So the answer to your question is yes, it's much more important to provide those skills where there's a known demand and where those skills don't yet exist.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments at this point? If not, any other description of how we proceed? Okay, Ms. Billheimer, why don't we, before we go to you, if there are no other comments or questions, may I have a motion to, I'm sorry, Mr. Connolly.
One other additional question came to mind as we were wrapping up there. You talked about what the letters, kind of the messaging of the letters to those that are being asked to move forward. Clearly there's someone here that the message will be, based on our understanding of your application and the statute, it does not qualify. Clearly you said earlier some of those might be adjusted, the applications could be changed, maybe we don't have a clear understanding of how it qualifies. They too can work directly with you versus just walking away, so to speak, and they'll have equal chance to sit down with you as one that's moving forward as well, correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
So you have before you, members, the recommendations of professional staff as to functionally the first sort, those that on its face appear to meet statutory criteria, and then we would go on to solicit an application from them and assist them in the ways it's been described. Those that on their face appear not to meet statutory criteria, we offer to work with them to see if their project is subject to being adjusted, and also bearing in mind the pending letters that we hope to receive from the presiding officers. You have those sorts before you. You have the report of Dr. Harper and Ms. Henderson before you. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Schoaf. Motion by Speaker Benz. Is there, are there questions? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In an abundance of caution and at the advice of counsel, particularly after the schooling we've gotten over the last few months, I went back and looked at all of these applications and looked for where Gulf Power Company's name may have shown up on a pre-application. And there were eight. We evaluated those. I'm happy to go through them individually with you. We're listed as partners. Our evaluation is none of those and neither our benefit nor me personally, and so I do not believe there's a conflict, but I wanted to put that on the record. I'm happy to, Susan, to give you the list of the ones that that I'm referring to. I am not going to abstain on those. I do not believe there's a conflict. I just wanted that on the record.
Anything else? Yes, Dr. Dana.
Thank you, Chairman. On that same note, I've provided a letter to Susan Skelton, which also outlines two or three proposals that I may have a conflict with, so I wanted that to be on record, and that would be the IHMC, where the IHMC is named on two proposals, and potentially another one with the Destin Charter Boat Association. Thank you.
Ms. Billheimer, we need a little advice here. One approach we might take in an abundance of caution is to divide the motion and separate out those items that that do not relate to a member's potential conflict and vote on those items separately, and then go back and vote on the items on which there may be a conflict, or a member in an abundance of caution wants to avoid even the appearance of a conflict and vote on those separately. What's your advice?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you could proceed in separating them out of an abundance of caution in the manner that you suggested. So starting with the ones where there is no conflict, and then the other ones where there may be even an appearance, not an actual conflict, but an appearance, you can separate.
Mr. Lee, did you wish to speak, please?
I do. I have one as well. I have served previously on the board of Florida's Great Northwest, and they have an application in. I have resigned my position with Florida's Great Northwest.
All right. Now, Susan, here's what we need to do, I think. Speaker Benz is going to keep us on track here if we get lost. I think we need a series of motions, and we're going to take a five-minute recess for you to develop those motions. And the first motion, and Ms. Beinler is going to help us here, the first motion would be all of those listed pre-apps where there is no conflict that's been mentioned at all, so that they can be taken as a group. Then give us a second group that, Mr. Connolly, do you wish to have the items where Gulf Power was mentioned taken out in a separate motion, or do you wish to proceed?
I wish to proceed.
All right. Then don't worry about the Gulf Power references, because they clearly don't produce a conflict. But be mindful of Dr. Dana's and Mr. Lee's conflicts. I am a former member of the of some committee at Florida's Great Northwest, so I can't vote on. They're not before us today. Okay, then I'm good. So you could. And Mr. Lee, did you? And
no.
Are you good then? Since Florida's Great Northwest. All right, we're going to take a five-minute break. We ask you to prepare those motions, and we will come back into session at 2:40. We stand at recess.
But that means that we're not going to ask you to vote on them. We're going to, the ones that have to do with IHMC and the fishermen, we're going to vote, the rest of us are going to vote.
Floor is clean, and a motion would be in order to approve the staff recommendations on all pre-applications except numbers 470 and 107. Is there such a motion? Speaker Benz, is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Shelf. Is there other questions? Is there discussion? All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. Showed adopted unanimously with Dr. Benz abstaining. And now...
Dr. Dana.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate it.
Dr.
Benz. I've called a lot worse in my life. That's my sister you're talking about.
That's right. I get my leaders mixed up here. And so now the motion, the second motion, is to approve the staff recommendations on pre-applications. I'm sorry, Dr. Dana, I made a mistake. You were shown as voting in favor of the prior motion.
That's correct.
All members voted in favor of the prior motion. Now the motion is to approve the staff recommendations on pre-applications 470 and 107, and this is the motion on which Dr. Dana will abstain. Are there questions? First of all, is there a motion maker?
So moved.
Moved by Mr. Connolly. Is there a second? Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Shelf. Are there questions? Is there discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay, showing Dr. Dana abstaining. All right. Thank you for that bit of preliminary gymnastics.
If you trained in the Florida House, you probably never would have.
That's right. I was not trained in the House. I was trained in the lower chamber.
No, it's the upper chamber.
I have to say that. All right. Now let's go back to that point in the agenda when Ms. Billheimer is to give us a quick reminder of the gift ban. Ms. Billheimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Directors, we thought as this process is moving along and you may be engaging in meetings and tours, that it was a good time to remind you of the gift ban that applies to each of you as members of the board. The gift ban itself appears in the conflict of interest policy. I think we've all been provided some background
training on that policy. But just broadly speaking, and because our area is known for its southern hospitality, we thought now was a good time to kind of remind you that Florida statutes preclude the either acceptance or solicitation of any gifts. And the term gift is broad. It covers real property, it covers the use of real property, the use of intangible property. But I think more importantly and kind of nuanced is it also precludes food and beverage. So when you're engaging in these meetings or going on tours of the facilities, the best kind of broad concept to take away from that is to bring nothing to the meeting and take nothing from the meeting. We do kind of remind everybody also, as you expend money for your own expenditures on travel and food and the like, obtain a receipt, and there's a process for you to get reimbursed. And again, all of the items, I mean, I can go through a couple of other ones that are a little more nuanced: plants, flowers, floral arrangements, those all constitute impermissible gifts. Services provided by persons pursuant to a professional license or certificate. So it's really anything of value. It could be very small. So there's really no de minimis exception or anything of the like. So we just thought now would be a good opportunity to remind you of that. The policy is on the Triumph's website. If you have any questions, please, we're always available to speak to you and to answer any questions.
Thank any you. Questions? If you dig deep enough into the history of the gift ban, you'll find the name of Dr. Speaker Benz. I don't know if he has any comments on the gift ban, but he told me once, don't even take a Diet Coke, Don.
The lobbyists didn't like me for a long time.
Any questions on this? I just have a quick comment. I've gotten some communications from folks in my county who were asking, is Triumph Gulf Coast being wined and dined? And I said, no, we're not. And we can't be, even if we wanted to be, and we don't want to be. So then somebody who follows the work of the county commission pretty closely sent me a receipt, and it said that apparently in my county, in Walton County, somebody is called the Triumph Coordinator, and your counties don't have to have a Triumph Coordinator, but they can if they want to. It's not necessary. It doesn't have anything to do with how people get funded, but if they want to, they can. But apparently the Triumph Coordinator had submitted a receipt to be paid for with taxpayer funds for some very expensive cigars, and noted on their Triumph. Well, so I was asked, did I smoke those cigars? And the answer is, my wife allows me to smoke one cigar a year, and I buy it myself. So I didn't smoke any Triumph cigars with a Triumph Coordinator from Walton County, and my suspicion is none of my colleagues did either. I only mention this to say that if Walton County or any other county wants to wine and dine anybody, wants to wine and dine each other, buy cigars for somebody, that's fine. But none of that has anything to do with us. None of it has anything to do with our professional staff. They are bound by the same gift point ban we are bound by. And so consequently, if that occurred, apparently it did, that's for Walton County to sort out. But as a Walton County taxpayer, I was not amused. But I wanted to assure the public that that is not going on with this board. It has nothing to do with this board or the Triumph process. Anything else on the gift ban issue? If not, we are part of the meeting that's always good because it keeps us grounded, and that is to hear from members of the public who have something to share with the board. And let's begin with Mayor Al Cathy from Mexico Beach. Mr. Mayor, it is good to see you. I drove through Mexico Beach today, reminded myself of the places that you've taken me in Mexico Beach, And it's good to see you. You're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Board members, I'm Al Cathy, Mayor of the City of Mexico Beach, and I appreciate the opportunity to address you today. We submitted an application for the construction of a concrete pier. Our existing pier is a wooden structure. It's 800 feet long, and 500 feet of it is part of the original design that was built in 1964. It has been deemed structurally compromised, and it must be closed during adverse weather conditions. We have the only open Gulf Pier, and I repeat, open Gulf Pier, east of the M.B. Miller Pier on Panama City Beach. That includes all of Eastern Bay County, Gulf County, and Franklin County. Our pier is a major attraction, not only to our city, but to our area. I'm going to take just a few moments and share with you some information, some facts, and some feelings about our city of why I felt the need to come to this podium. First and foremost, we're part of Bay County. We're in the central time zone. We have a population of 1,200 residents. That's less than 1% of the total population of Bay County. We have a taxable value of $395 million. That's bumping 3% of the total total taxable value of Bay County. And we are supported by a hardworking mom and pop business community. We have no Lowe's, we have no Home Depots, we have no Sam's or Walmart's, we have no CVS. We have no shopping malls, shopping centers. We have no fast food chain restaurants. We have no schools, as in charter, public, private, or vocational. We have no ports, as in airports or seaports. We have no parks, as in industrial parks or pier parks. I can assure you that no one in Mexico Beach spent the night at a Holiday Inn Express. We are quaint, we're unique, we're different. We have a different type of life and a quality of life, and all of those things are treasures to us. I'm not standing here today for sympathy, and I'm not sharing this information as if this is some poor me presentation. I came here to be open, honest, truthful, and forthright with this board. City of Mexico Beach, no matter how we put on paper, we are never going to compete with mainstream Bay County, or for that matter, mainstream Florida Gulf Coast. And in being truthful with you, we aren't looking to be transformed. We aren't going to partner with somebody that on paper that we might be able to submit an application that will show you that we're going to create 150 new jobs. And we certainly will not be the most economic enhancing application in the stack. We aren't going to mask ourselves in an attempt to move up the food chain for funding. We aren't going to masquerade you in an attempt to fool you or trick you or think we're somebody that we aren't, so that we can try to stay in the ring with our competition as far as funding. We're going to stay true to who we are. We're going to dance with the one we brought. We're going to be comfortable in our own skin. Simply put, we are never going, no matter how many lines we fill in or how many circles we color, how many boxes we check, we're never going to present to you an application that's going to set your hair on fire. It's just not simply who we are. The city of Mexico Beach, the loss that we experienced during the oil spill crisis is just as great as any along the Gulf Coast region. I'm here today to ask you to give us an opportunity to share in the rewards and the gains that will be realized by the monetary distribution of funds that this board oversees. We believe the statutes and the language in those statutes should allow us a place at the table. Ladies and gentlemen, simply put, a concrete pier to Mexico Beach is a big deal. It's a game changer. I leave you with this thought. We were extended an invitation to the banquet, and we accepted it. We were given a menu, we placed an order, and we feel deserving and justified in being served. I thank you for your time, and more importantly, I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Next, Mayor Anderson from Lynn Haven. Mayor Anderson, as of today, one of your residents and constituents is a member of this board, Mr. Lee.
We're very happy that you have him on the board. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. I appreciate this opportunity to meet all of you and to say hello this morning. And I just wanted to make a few comments about the applications that the City of Lynn Haven has submitted and the importance that they have for our community. Lynn Haven, similar to Mexico Beach, is not generally the city that people fly into when they come to the Gulf Coast for their vacation. They're looking for Panama City Beach. But on our side of the bridge, we have the bulk of the population of the county, not only in just Lynn Haven, but in those smaller cities like Mexico Beach, like Parker, Callaway, Youngstown, all of those rural areas. And most of those communities, if you look at our school district, are contained with Title I schools, meaning that we have a lot of poor families in that area. These children don't have the opportunity that many children have in their communities for sports parks and to be able to compete with teams from other areas. And so one of our applications, while it is to expand a sports park, to purchase another 83 acres and be a partner with you in that, while it doesn't appear to be on the verge of a huge economic impact, we're training these young children and young adults to be team workers and to develop values and to develop an importance in their community and to keep them safe and to put them in the right direction so that they can go to these schools and they can become trained workers in the workforce. So while it may not seem to have a direct impact in that area, it certainly has an impact in building the character in these young people who might otherwise not have that opportunity because we are so crowded we can't really take any more at this time. Another aspect is that we would be creating 15 at least in the beginning full-time jobs by that expansion and also impacting many other areas of our community. If we're able to bring in these types of competitive sports, it's going to impact the restaurants in all of these small towns as well as ours. It's going to impact the hotels, and it will have great economic impact for the Lynn Haven area as well as the smaller cities that surround us. And then in regard to our second application for an EOC in the city of Lynn Haven, we are surrounded by water, which is North Bay, and also we are surrounded by water in other areas with many lagoons and bayous. And when we have even a significant rain, Lynn Haven floods. And so in the event of a Category 3 or above storm, such as Opal, which hit us in the 90s, or some other disaster or impact to our community, we believe that an EOC in Lynn Haven would be beneficial in many ways. The EOC that Bay County maintains is on the other side of the Bailey Bridge, which would mean that our emergency workers would have to cross that bridge, and once winds reach 45 and above, they can't do that. And so our thought is that we would like to keep our emergency workers and our first responders in a building where they can be close to our residents and be out and about helping them in the event of some type of event, whether it would be a storm or some other disaster. We would also use this facility for training and for teaching our residents how to help themselves in the event of a disaster, training our young people from several of our schools how they can help. It could also be a center for distributing sandbags and other food articles, and we just feel that proximity would be great. And also, if for some reason the Bay County EOC needed assistance on our side of the bay, in the event of some kind of storm or other impact, we would have that assistance as well, that we could connect with them. So I appreciate the opportunity to tell you about these two projects that we feel very strongly about, and even though some of the economic impact may not be immediately visible when you look at them, when you begin to think about how they could change, I think, transformationally our area, I would really appreciate your second look at them. So thank you very much for the opportunity for letting Lynn Haven be here today and to put our perspective in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Joe Taylor. Mr. Taylor. Marie Marshall. Ms. Marshall. Thank you for being here, and you're recognized, ma'am.
Thank you. I didn't come with prepared remarks, but it's lovely to see an old colleague from Panama City. Speaker Benson and I worked together years ago when I was executive director of Healthy Start for Bay, Franklin, and Gulf Counties. Even at 83, I'm still trying to work on behalf of not only historic preservation, but the young children here. Our studies show that the earlier children are in a good learning environment, the better for their full growth. And so here in Franklin, we are attempting a very brave thing to take over the portion of the old high school and create an early learning center. We have a wonderful retired couple, Dave and Michaelyn Watts, who are leading the effort, and we're collaborating with Head Start from Tallahassee, which threatened to leave us, but we convinced them to stay. And we're attempting to create, using early Head Start funding, and hopefully a Montessori school, which is new in town. We're hoping to create an early learning center so that this county can enjoy graduation from high school rate, that is for the 21st century, as well as economic development. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Is there anyone? You haven't missed a beat, Ms. Marshall.
Is there anyone else from the public who wished to speak but did not sign up? If so, sir, why don't you come forward, identify yourself, and we're going to use the Ben's rule here, try to hold your remarks to 3 minutes.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. President, members of the board. I'm Michael Langton, Langton Consulting. I felt empowered to have to come up and say something for the high-powered, evil grant consultants.
I didn't say evil.
I added that for
the
labor.
The floor is open for amendments.
For local character. Thank you, Mr. President.
That was good.
I've been following this process since the beginning. I've attended almost every one of your meetings and tried to be very productive and helpful in terms of recommending things. For instance, in my firm, I employ five people, and we struggle along and try to do a good job for our clients. I mean, it's a for-profit business, and we work hard at it, and I would hope that you wouldn't be so negative about that opportunity. For instance, I submitted 3 applications for a client. All 3 made the first cut, and I charged them a total of $5,000. So everybody's not out there to rip off everybody, but I would like to give you a suggestion. I've made this suggestion before, Mr. President, and that is Restore allows a reasonable expense for grant preparation. If you really want to level the playing field, because not everybody can even get to Florida, Enterprise Florida, or get to the department, or the department may not have time. You had 115 different applicants. If you really want to level the playing field between the more sophisticated counties and the business entity in a small city, allow a reasonable cost as part of the grant cost, as part of the budget, a reasonable cost for grant preparation. It's typical in the industry, and it would help you achieve what you want. That way you're not forcing people to spend huge amount of sums on evil grant consultants, but you are allowing some professional expertise to come to the table. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who would like to speak? Yes, sir. Thank you for taking the time to be here. If you had to identify yourself for the record, please.
Rich Walker, 1106 Michigan Avenue, Lynn Haven, Florida. I'm not here to represent Lynn Haven. I'm just here as a somebody, because I get questions from our people in our town, through the church, through the organizations I belong to. They don't have an understanding of this whole process. They seem to think that my wife and I have an understanding, so they ask the questions to find out, what did they really say? the questions that come up, and I deal with one specific item that is on your agenda for the selection of one applicant. I applaud you for your attitude of looking at this as if the development, if that is what's happening, is going to already be done by the city. That's good, because most of these projects are in the SIP plans for the city. Okay? I applaud that. I also applaud the look at private companies being benefited by these projects that they're soliciting to you. One of them is concern of mine is in Bay County, the total allotted money is $15 million in this run through. Okay? Of that, this one project alone is asking for $10 million. One project. This project was never on the agenda for Bay County to take a look at, to present to you. This is a different project. It come in somehow, I don't know, and was not observed by anybody except a few citizens. The project itself looks like it's an infrastructure project that the developer, and needless to say, what I call the, I don't call, but the Economic Development Officer for the state of Florida has labeled as the evil developers, and that's a bad term, but that term goes. This seems to benefit them. Seems to be a bailout, just like General Motors was for the United States of America. I don't understand why, and the people I talk to and ask questions, why we're doing this. Again, back to this one project, and I applaud you. You're going to be looking at them again as they come through. It's important to look at who is this benefiting. Seems to me, and the one project that I'm mentioning or alluding to, is to the effect of the developer. The project is already under the umbrella of the city in its comprehensive plan. It's already under the development in the umbrella of the CRA. And it's already under the umbrella of what the developer has to do, excluding city, state, tax money. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Was there someone else who wished to speak? Please come forward.
Good afternoon. My name is Dale Robitaille. I live in Lynn Haven at 1805 New Hampshire Avenue. I've lived in 1805 for 18 years, which is longer than we've lived anywhere else. And there's a reason for that. Came down from Atlanta, and I worked my butt off up there. And I came down for a little peace and quiet, a little quality of life. That's my big word, quality of life. In Lynn Haven, our mayor rides around on a scooter. In Lynn Haven, one of her issues was golf cart.
Now, sir, we're not going to talk about other public officials.
Okay, I just want to make this one point.
We're going to be civil. If you've got a problem with the mayor, you go see the mayor.
I'm dragging her up.
Sir, we're not going to talk about other public officials.
Okay. In Lynn Haven, we're allowed to have golf carts on our streets. In Lynn Haven, we're allowed to ride scooters. In Lynn Haven, we have crab races. My point I'm making is, in Lynn Haven, we also restored an old building, Robert Hall. The point I'm making is, I understand fully there aren't any jobs around us. I see young people every day going off to college and never coming back. And I think it's very important that we develop an economic base. Very important that we provide for our young people to stay at home to build our country. However, it's very important that we have a quality of life at the same time. I'm telling you, as someone that spent 30 years in Atlanta, quality of life does not exist there, but you can get a job in a minute. So when you make your decisions, please consider quality of life as a most important issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Does anyone else wish to address the board? Anyone else? And let's go back to Mr. Taylor. If he happened to step out, he had listed himself as interested in speaking. Is he here? Does he wish to speak? If not, we'll go to final comments from board members. Speaker Benz.
I think I already said enough. Pam, you're up.
Dr. Dana.
I just want to thank the staff that's been put in place. I know you guys did a lot of hard work. You hit the ground running, and in just a matter of a few weeks have really brought us to a different place in this whole process. So I appreciate you and look forward to working with you all. Thank you.
Mr. Lee.
I echo Dr. Dana's comments on staff. Thank you for helping to guide us, and we appreciate all the hard work that you put into, and I'm looking forward to getting up to speed and continuing to learn and grow in this organization. Thank you for the kind words, Senator Gates and Speaker Benz.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Schoaf.
I'd like to thank the City of Apalachicola and Franklin County for hosting this, and thank everybody for coming here. This is really a nice place to live and be and work and everything else, and really encourage other people to think about ways that they could use Triumph money in this area and in all 8 counties, and submit some more applications. Give us some more to look at.
Mr. Riggs.
I'll yield my time to the ever so eloquent Mr. Connolly.
Mr. Connolly.
No further comments.
The most eloquent comment of the day. The only final comment I would make is that if at the moment we have $300 million on deposit, we have $1.2 billion left to come. We have over $1 billion in pre-apps. If we spent every dime we had now, 70% of the people in the room would go away disappointed. But we're not going to spend every dime we have now, I would expect, because I'm sure there are good ideas and there are plans that will be in the offing as people begin to understand more and more about what this board's decision calculus is, and as new ideas come about in your own communities. So there will be a sorting process. Anytime there is an embarrassment of riches like this, riches in the sense that we have so many people who have so many ideas for making their community better, that's good. We have an embarrassment of riches in the sense that over time, if all goes according to plan, $1.5 billion to diversify and transform the economy of Northwest Florida. But not everyone will go home with a blue ribbon, and that's because we have to undertake a decision-making process based on what will generate the greatest economic value. As Dr. Harper pointed out, in the Deepwater Horizon oil spill consequences, there are all sorts of consequences, but one of them was there were billions and billions of dollars spread out among local governments to be used for Restore Act purposes, environmental purposes, educational purposes of one sort or another. Our small slice, big money, but a small slice of their overall pie, is to be used to remedy economic damages and to remedy those damages with transformative economic impact. And that will be the lodestone of our proceedings as we go forward. With that said, Mr. Lee moves to rise.
Thank you. Same to you. You've got a longer ways to go than I do.